You're listening to episode 2 of season 2 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, Storyteller Tribe! We have New York Times bestselling author Rita Williams Garcia with us on the show today. Rita is a Newbery Honor winner, a three-time Coretta Scott King Author Award winner, and a two-time National Book Award finalist, just to name a few of her accomplishments. Rita shares inspiring personal stories and really actionable tidbits for writers. Now let's jump right in.
Hi, everyone. Guess what? We have Rita Williams Garcia with us today. I am so excited to introduce her to you guys. If you haven't heard about her already, Rita is incredible. She's an absolutely fantastic storyteller, and I'm so honored to have her with us today. Rita, how are you?
I am feeling good. The snow cannot keep me down. I'm ready to talk with y'all.
Amazing. I kind of miss the snow. I moved over to LA from the East Coast, so I kind of miss the snow. It's kind of refreshing to hear about it, and I'm glad that you're doing okay and on the show. So thank you for being here with us today and for your time. So Rita, I'd love to ask you how you fell in love with writing.
I believe I told my first lie and a star was born. I always had an overactive imagination. I could never tell things the way they exactly happen. I always had to throw something on top of it. If my mother asked me a simple question, yes, I'd give her the answer, but then I would find that opening and that strand and I would follow it. And my mother would say, oh, that was good, Rita. You need to write that down. And I never caught on. I would always go, yeah, that's right. That was good. And I'd start writing. So I've been keeping notebooks and writing since I was really little. I taught myself to read, with the help of my sister. I can't take all the credit. And as soon as I could read a story or follow a story in picture books, I just started making things up. So writing was always a part of me. But I have to say that I really began to take writing and the prospect of being published seriously at the age of 12. And I don't mean that as a joke. I was quite serious about that. I went to the library around the corner from us in Hollis, Queens. My family had relocated to Queens from Seaside, California, and we were restricted as to where we could go because my parents felt it was dangerous for us to be out there looking for a kickball game. And so the one place we could go was the library, and I found the reference section. I would check out books like The Writer's Handbook, The Writer's Market, The Literary Marketplace, and I would pore over the chapters and learn what it was to be a writer, how to prepare a manuscript to send SACE, a self-addressed stamped envelope. This is way before email submissions, and the rules of the road, making sure that my manuscript looked professional, reading through a market and finding out what they wanted, but even more important, what they paid. 10 cents a word, 7 cents a word. Playboy paid a lot of money. So did Ladies' Home Journal and so forth and so on. So I was writing stories beyond my grasp and sending them out and getting those rejection letters. And although that provided a lot of comedy around the house for my brother and sister who were older, you know, I just took it in stride. I said, you know what? This is what writers go through. I've read The Writer's Handbook. This is part of the whole journey of being a writer. And so I took my rejections proudly, and I would fix up my stories. By fixing them up, I would cross out a word or two, and then I'd resubmit them elsewhere. So that was my introduction to writing when I was about 12 or so.
And I notice in your books, they're mostly for young adults. So what drew you specifically to write for young adults?
Well, I wasn't really planning to write for young adults. I always wanted to write a novel for adults. But when I was in college, my last year, I was working with teenagers who struggled with reading. So I looked for a book that I thought they might respect. the character and want to go along for the journey, and I could not find that book. First of all, let me just say, these girls were, it was four girls, and they were, by my mother's standards, grown. One had a child already, and I think she was the baby of the bunch. And another was seeing an older man, and, you know, just all of these things. And they had life experience way beyond mine, but they couldn't read above the, I would say they were around the third grade reading level. And so it was very hard to find a book that, you know, they could grasp the words and keep going and like the story, respect the character. At that time, that there was no multicultural. There were a few books out there, but I struggled to find them. So I started writing for them. It just so happened that I was taking a class with Richard Price, author of Blood Brothers, Wanderers, Clockers. I needed to produce homework, and I figured kill two birds with one stone. And so I'd write a chapter, a very short chapter, read it to the girls. And before I knew it, they were acting out the parts. So I started to write it in play form so everybody could have a part. And that was how I got my girls going. And before I knew it, Blue Tight's big butt had been born. You know, it was around a time that men were beginning to really notice girls who were old enough to be their daughters. It was during that early, like, Brooke Shields kind of era. And so a lot of girls in the neighborhood were dealing with the pressures of older men. And how do you deal with that? And how do you deal with being a poor girl in need of everything from finances to food to just a shoulder to cry on or someone to talk to. And then there's this older predatory man. And so I thought that was a very real everyday story because I saw it everywhere. Who knew it would be so hard to publish this story? Writing it was easy. Publishing it was yet another issue. It took about 8 years before I found a publisher, and I had to go through a lot of revision, a lot of change. The thing was, fresh out of school, well, I wasn't compliant. I didn't want to change anything. Are you kidding me? There were no books like my book. No one was telling this story. No one understood what it was to be a girl in the hood with some booty and everybody is trying to talk to your parts, but not to you. I figured, okay, if I tell this story, it's going to sell like gangbusters because everybody's going to know this story. Mm. But, you know, again, I'm so glad I went through rejection early so that it didn't shock me all at once, because certainly it came one letter after the other after the other. I wasn't as courageous as I was at 12. At 22, I was angry. I was an angry young woman, and I could not understand why my book was not good enough. Why weren't they accepting my book? After all, my story is the truth. Mm. And all of that other stuff out there is a bunch of high school fairy tale, you know, no offense to the author. But, you know, at that time, at 22, and trying to tell a very real story for an underserved reader, you know, it was just very important for me to be heard and to have my story out there. And yet people were saying, well, editors were saying, well, can you make this crossover more? You know, she's 15 years old. Can you make her 18? You know, all kinds of things that just didn't ring true to me. So it was just very easy for me to quit. But it think about like 7 years, 6, 7 years before I found the right fit. I almost gave up.
And talking about that, you were mentioning a lot about rejections and your story being truthful. That actually reminds me of your book, No Laughter Here. And that really covers, wow, like a very, very heavy topic, especially for young adults. What was that process like, trying to get No Laughter Here published? And can you please tell the listeners an overview about No Laughter Here?
No Laughter Here is a story of friendship between two girls, two 10-year-olds, an African-American girl, Akila, and an African girl, Victoria. Well, when Victoria returns from visiting Nigeria, her homeland, she's different. And Akila can't understand what has happened to her friend. Why won't she participate in school? Why won't she run? Where is her personality? Where is her humor? Where is Victoria? She can't understand why she has changed so much. And then she learns that she has undergone the ritual of genital cutting or female genital mutilation. So yes, this is a very hard story to tell. It's very hard to put it in a voice and in the hands of much younger readers. Normally I write for say about 13, 14 and up, but this has a much younger voice. So I imagine someone 11 and 12 reading it. That's not necessarily how the breakdowns happen, but that was in my head. And so that was a challenge for the publisher. I had already had the relationship with the publisher and they supported me on this book, but they knew that they would be in for quite a challenge. We had everything from feminist groups saying, no, this is not the true story. You're not making it horrific enough. And then on the other side, we had the gatekeepers who said, oh no, this book does not belong in a middle school. It belongs in high school. Here's the beautiful thing. Eventually, a book will find her reader and it will open that reader up in ways that she has not been open, and she's ready. And so I got the chance to hear from my readers. They wrote to me in droves. I put my email in the back of the book. I think maybe before people were doing that, this was very early 2000s. I heard from not only the girls who I thought would really be attracted to this story, but I heard from their mothers. I heard from their teachers. I heard from librarians, and I heard from boys. And so that was a big surprise. I did not expect boys to want to read this book, but I got a lot of response from young men under the age of 13, talking about things going on in the world, relating to circumcision because of male circumcision, and just relating to it on different levels. So it was an education for me as well. I have to say that I was very fortunate in having a publisher that was willing to fight for this book. And to this day, even though it is no longer in print, the library copies are still out there. And so it's still being widely read. And so occasionally I will hear from someone doing work on the subject, teaching classes of all different levels about customs, rituals, and using this book. And the book is out there doing what it's meant to do, even beyond my intentions. And that's one thing that writing has opened up for me, is just that whole notion that, yes, I might have my own ideas, my own intentions, but then once that book goes out in the world, it belongs to the world, and they need to grab onto that book or to wrestle with it on their own terms. And so
that's beautiful.
It's just an amazing idea to really confront as a writer of a work that you might think of as your own.
Yeah, absolutely. And I admire you so much for bringing social awareness through your books, especially to the young adult population. I think that's really tough, an actual hurdle to jump over, because for me, I have younger sisters who are, I see them like my own kids. They're about 9-10 years younger than me. And there are a lot of topics out there where I have to admit I'm scared to approach them with and to talk to them about. And I think it takes a lot of courage too. And with that, Rita, I want to know, how do you decide to talk about these specific topics like female genital mutilation and also the Black Panther movement in One Crazy Summer? How do you choose these topics?
There's always a point in my life where I say, that interests me. I don't know how, I don't know when, but I'm going to write about that. It was the same for teen pregnancy when I wrote Like Sisters on the Home Front. I knew I wanted to write about a girl who was about 13 or 14 with a child. It was the same with No Laughter Here. I heard about female genital mutilation in the 80s. And then I read a lot about it, especially as Alice Walker was writing about it. But there was something missing. And from the adult conversation, it was that it was happening to little girls, from infant or as young girls, maybe around 8 years old. And so once I wrapped my head around the fact that an 8-year-old was involved, I felt that, okay, that meant I could get into 8-year-old awareness and now let that navigate me, as opposed to letting the subject matter navigate me. And it's the same thing with the Black Panther movement. I was around 10 years old in 1967, when I really started to take notice of the Black Panthers. I know I have family members who were involved and involved with the Black nationalist movement. And so I was just very interested. I had big ears and I listened to my mother's conversations whenever I could. But I was also very much glued to the news, watching the news, reading newspapers, and just seeing that everything was changing and that we were going from "we shall overcome" to "power to the people, seize the time." And so as a very young person, I was reading books by Eldridge Cleaver and reading the transcript, The Trial of Bobby Seale, with William Kunstler as his attorney. I was very much into Joanne Chesimard and Angela Davis. I just could not get enough. And yes, this from someone who was very much into the Black Power movement and very much into Star Trek. I was a serious Trekkie. So, you know, I had both my childhood, but also that interest of what was going on in the world. I knew that I was going to write about the Black Panther movement, but again, I had to find that I felt was most important. And for me, it was that children were involved in the movement at so many different levels. When you hear the stories of Marianne Williamson, who is the adopted daughter of Jane Fonda, when you meet people like Fred Hampton, who was a baby when, well, actually, I believe he was in utero when his father was assassinated, and so forth. You hear these stories from children, those who were very little and those who were actually going to rallies or going to the schools or the camps or what have you. These were kids who had all of that doctrine in their heads, not just in their heads, but actually practicing. So I said to myself, now this is going to become a children's movement. And I know just the 3 characters to bring it to life. And so once I knew my characters and who they were and their parents and had a sense of the family story that kind of converged with the Black Panther movement, I knew I had more than just a history lesson to tell, and that I could bring this to much younger readers and invite them into a movement, a time that's barely ever talked about, but was very much a part of bringing Black presence to life in the world.
I'm sure there are listeners out there who are working on their own stories that they would love to share with young adults as well, and bring social awareness through their stories as well. How would you advise these storytellers on weaving in social awareness without making it sound like they're preaching to the kids? What would be your biggest advice to them?
I would say that the most important thing is to always lead through the character. The character is always going to tell you what the story is and just how much of the social issue is going to come into the story. And I think that's the hardest thing. When you're doing the research, you can get so much information. And this is what I found with writing No Laughter Here. I so got into everything about the culture of female genital mutilation and then just what it meant to the practicing culture. That's one thing that I think we tend to forget. And so it's that whole thing of not just getting the information, but trying to understand it from so many different sides. And then once you have a lot of that, then you want to then filter it through the character's own person, their own personal conflict, who they are. So it helps a lot to really have your character developed, or because we're 9 times out of 10, we're exploring our writing. We don't know a whole lot about the character. And so you're learning. And so what you want to do is to be able to find those opportunities where you can take inner conflict and then bounce that off against or impinge against that big external conflict or subject matter, so that it's more than the character talking about the issue, telling us about the issue. They're going through their own drama on the inside. And so there's that conflict that's going on. And we know that conflict is good for the story. So we have to feel our character invested in struggle in some way, not just in the very, oh, this is happening to me, what shall I do? But something that informs us about their character so that we can relate to those very interesting aspects of character. And then you can even find different types of analogy or connection between some aspect of their inner conflict and the greater world that's going on. And when I say greater world, I am talking about the subject matter, whether that's going to be FGM or Panthers or Black Lives Matter or whatever that is. But the more that you know your character, the more you're going to define what your story will be. And that's always the thing to keep in mind. And then the hardest thing is to let the story belong to the character. We all want to have our say about what's going on. I guess that's why we're writing. But once you create the character, it's really the character's world and what is important to them. And often that's at odds with us. I say let the character win, because you're going to get to go out into the world on the podium and talk about these great issues. Your readers will get to read your characters. So there will always be that opportunity to talk about those great social issues directly. But let your characters live their lives and have their struggle while these great issues swirl around them. And believe me, your readers will have a more personal experience with both your character, but also with what's going on. And in that way, I think they get more out of what it is you want to say than just simply straight up telling them about the issue.
Thank you for sharing all those amazing tips. And I'd love to know any advice for the listeners on how they can approach literary agents.
I got an agent fresh out of college. I showed promise, but I did not want to revise my novel. That's very bad. Hold your hand out. That's me smacking it. Bad. So I didn't realize what an agent was all about. I did know that I had to have one. So I did what the writer's handbook told me. Go get an agent. That's how you know you have something worth selling, if someone wants to represent you. So I did that, but I didn't really understand the process. And so after about a year with my agent, that was that for me. I am still agentless.
Oh.
Don't be me. Don't do what I have done. Don't.
Wait, so how are you able to successfully publish all these books?
I am a dinosaur. So after about 6 years of being unpublished, I went back to the writer's market. I read very carefully all the market descriptions to find a publisher that sounded like they were looking for my book. Whereas before, I just threw my manuscript out into the world to see what would stick. Okay, bad. Of course, I was going to be rejected. But then I found a very narrow search of publishers that was looking for realistic fiction and multicultural. Now, that was a new word in the 80s, multicultural. So I realized that, those were my buzzwords, and I had to skew toward those publishers. And so out of that small group that I sent my query letter to, I think 6 were interested, and I sent my manuscript out, and I got 2 acceptances, but it was really the one from Lodestar Books at E.P. Dutton, Penguin, from Rosemary Brosnan that made me say, I think she really likes my character. And that is who I went with. And I have been with her ever since.
Wow.
So we've been together going on many decades, many, many. So unfortunately, I am not very helpful in that way because, like I said, I'm a dinosaur and it does not go that way. And I advise no one to do it as I've done it, or if you have done it, get an agent. I'm going to say I am very well taken care of at my current publishing house. And so I have no incentive to go out there. But I've worked with a lot of writers, Vermont College of Fine Arts, where I am on faculty. And many of my students go on to publish and they go out there and they meet agents. And it's a good thing, a positive thing to land an agent. So Rita, 22 years old, hold your hand out and get a slap on the wrist.
You're so funny. So if you could do it over again at 22, you would be approaching these agencies. And by doing that, would you be cold calling them or emailing them your manuscript and cover letter? Is that how you would do it?
That would be one of my options. I would probably go to group meetings such as the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrations, SCBWI. They are throughout the country, actually, and even outside of the United States, and they offer the best publishing industry advice that you can get. And it's very friendly. And there's a lot on every aspect of marketing yourself and making those connections. So SCBWI is where you want to start. If you have absolutely no connections, that's where you start. And then I'm sure there are colleges that have programs where you can go and meet, have one-on-one meet and greets with industry professionals. A lot of colleges where there are MFA programs will host such an event. Make connections with that college. Even if you're not part of the MFA program, they might host events that are open to the public that will allow you an entry into the publishing world, meeting editors, meeting other authors. It's so important to have someone else to read your work, because if you're not willing to share your work with other readers, it's going to be even harder to share with a prospective agent. I would also say just doing your research, reading books that you think are similar to yours in terms of themes and style, perhaps, and then finding out, well, what are they doing? Who are they with? That might be a way to go. It's always the well-researched writer that has that edge. And that was something that I do kind of pat myself on the back about. It took me a lot of rejection, years of rejection, to kind of say, well, maybe I'm doing this wrong. But the more that you know about the kind of writing that you're doing, the more you'll be able to make those choices about who is best to represent you. I'm sure there are books out there that lists agents, like The Literary Marketplace, which is a huge book, or like The Writer's Market, which might have its own specialized book about agents. I would say always, first and foremost, join SCBWI or join a children's literary critique group. It's just the best source of information. Check out Kidlit TV. It's online and it has an awful lot of ideas about marketing, but also about getting published. And you get to hear from people who are entering publishing, just getting their first contracts, and people who have published and are trying new things. So Kidlit TV is another great source of information for people trying to get into publishing.
And when, you know, talking about how important it is to be open to revisions and letting people read your work, sharing your work, what do you think about mentors as a writer? What is your thought about having mentors? Is it necessary to become a successful author? Or do you think it's okay, you can kind of make it and coast by? What are your thoughts about that?
Oh, by all means, coast by. Y'all get in that little boat and go ride those torrential waves. Let me know how that works for you. Well, that was my tact. It eventually worked for me 30 years later. So there is nothing like having a mentor, having a mentoring group, a supportive group. Make sure that it is truly supportive. Sometimes you can get into a really negative environment. That does happen because we're all really trying to get there. And so in getting there, we might try to take someone down while they're trying to get up and while we're trying to move up. Those things happen. There are opportunities out there to find mentoring groups or to find a mentor, someone. It could be a retired agent, a retired editor. It could be someone who's still active in the field. You might want to take a continuing ed class in children's literature or writing for children and young adults. And from there, you might find your peer group. There are many ways to go about that, but it's so important because you have to hear what your work sounds like on many different levels. On a craft level, because there's just so much that a writer has to think about. The thing we think about most is shape of story, narrative point of view, character development, all of those different things that really start to make that story take possession of itself. And really good ears out there and people with some craft know-how can really talk you through what is working with your novel and what is problematic or raises questions about your manuscript. And so you really have to be open to that. But it's really all about finding that right fit that works for you. Because why? Writers can be stubborn. I know this. I am one of them. So you really have to find that fit that's going to work for you. It's out there.
I'd love to turn this back to you and ask you some more fun personal things.
Okay.
I know that you studied dance and economics in college. Now that is awesome. Tell me, how the heck was that? And also, if you've used that in your writings, has it inspired you at all or have you not used it at all? I'm sure you dance at home with your hubby, but, you know, tell us. I want to know. It's so fun. I read that. And I was like, oh my gosh, she's so cool.
Did you really think that? Okay, we'll start backwards. I will tell you about economics.
Okay.
I saw this guy on campus. He had the world's most perfect afro.
What?
And I followed him across campus to see where was Mr. Perfect Afro going. And he went into Roosevelt Hall. And by the time I got in there, he was gone. So I asked, what do they teach here? And someone said, well, this is mostly economics. And an economics major was born. And then I realized, hey, I can use economics. I can change the system so that we could take the wealth from the wealthy and distribute it to the poor. And then we will all have money. We will all overcome, you know, so
Robin Hood over
here. So win-win. So that's where that began. And dance. Well, there was always a dancer in me, but I was kind of shy and I had these huge knockers when I was a kid. I was like a double D cup when I was like in the sixth grade, and that was just, oh my God, traumatic.
What? I would say lucky. At least you have boobs. I'm struggling for a full-size A over here. Come on.
I would have donated back then, but I kind of like them now, so I...
Damn it. Oh, man. Missed my chance.
So I knew that I had a dancer inside me and that I had to deal with it before I left school and went out into the world to be a worker bee. So in college, I took dance in college, but I also went out to the city to take professional classes at Alvin Ailey. And that was a very important thing for me to do because I could see that even with limited dance skill, I had a little something. So I had my own dance company while I was in school. I danced at every opportunity. Did you need a dancer? I was there. I did every kind that that anybody needed. African dance, disco, folk dancing, jazz, everything. Dancer, I would fake it. I would go to auditions and just fake it like it was my business to be a world-class Faker Rooney. My last dance audition was for Sophisticated Ladies with the grand tap master, Henry Letang, as the choreographer. And so I said, oh, that's Henry Letang. Oh my God. Okay, Rita, make this good. So I went out there and I just razzmatazzed with the best of them. And then somehow Henry just kind of winked at me like, I know you can't tap, but I'm going to give you a chance. And so I was on the list, and then it was time for me to sing because you had to be able to sing. Well, I did not take after my father's side of the family, my father's side with the gospel singers, the doo-wop singers, rappers, and R&B, excuse me. Let me not forget the R&B singers. No, I did not take after them. I took after my mother's side of the tone-deaf family.
Oh, boy.
So I said, he knows my music. Hit it, Harry. T for two. And I sang it like Bugs Bunny because I knew I could not sing and I just refused to even try. And so that was the end of my dance career. But boy, when I went down in flames, it was the Hindenburg. It was great.
Oh my goodness. Do you find time to dance nowadays, like just for a hobby on the side, minus the singing?
I box now.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So in that way, I sort of dance with a left hook you wouldn't believe.
That's really cool, Rita. And I'd love to know if there's anything in your real life that made it into any of your books. Hint, hint, hubby.
Okay. So many years ago in junior high, I only had eyes for my notebook. So I did not notice my now husband. So we went on to high school and something happened in between junior high and high school. Doing, there was a cute boy in the back of the bus. Oh my goodness. I was so shy that every time I'd look up, I would be writing in my notebook, of course, because that's what Rita did. I would be writing my novel. So every time I would look up, he would kind of look up and catch me, and then I'd look back down, and I was just mortified but aww, thrilled at the same time. Well, we didn't speak to each other but maybe once or twice. So 40 years later, I get this Facebook request for a friend, and I just figured, oh, okay, click. And so he asked me to go out, and I was like, well, who is this? And he said, you might know me as this nickname from high school. And I thought, oh, cute boy in the back of the bus.
Oh,
we were married a year and a half later.
That is insane. It's crazy how Facebook can bring us back together again like that. That's incredible. And now that was in your book, your first book, right?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, Rita, that's amazing. And I would actually also like to segue in to something that where I'd like for my listeners to have some hope, because all writers go through ups and downs and a lot of downs. So if there is a time where you felt really stuck in a rut, or you felt like you couldn't get yourself out of a certain situation, could you please share that moment with us and how you got yourself out of it?
Okay, so I'm going to talk about my novel, Jumped. It took me close to 2 years to write that novel. I envisioned it one way, and the more I wrote, the more I hated it. I hated the characters. They all sounded the same. I didn't like them. I didn't like the story. There was nothing about the story that I liked. It took a while, but I had to create whole and separate characters. Well, as whole as they were going to be, because this book is partly satire, and so the characterizations are not terribly deep. But each person is their own person, and I had to begin to respect that. And it really took me a long time to find an in with each character and to really crystallize that the shape of the novel. I knew what it was I wanted to do. It was very hard for me to open up and to let it be just a little bit more in some places and a lot less in others. And so it was just a constant battle. The novel was about one girl knowing another girl was going to beat up a third girl. Well, all three of those girls conspired to beat me up as I was writing and rewriting. It took many drafts to get it right. And when I finally had it, I knew it immediately. But it really took going through all of those layers, all of those drafts to really get the story and to trust it.
And Rita, to contrast that, what is your proudest, most exciting moment in your career?
Okay, there are two that are vying for each other.
Okay.
I'm going to go back to the one, which is I've written a trilogy, which did not mean to be a trilogy, but nonetheless, there it is, set in the 1960s. And the first book was One Crazy Summer. It was winter 2011. And I was at Vermont College of Fine Arts, and we were streaming in the announcements for the Midwinter ALA Awards. And when they called my name for the Coretta Scott King Author Award, I almost imploded. I knew that I had won a Newbery honor, but I didn't know about the Coretta Scott King Author Award, mainly because I'm not very good about having my cell phone around or on or or charged or any of that. And history will then repeat itself a few years later, recently, but I digress. I still can't put it quite into words, but to have that recognition, to have the community recognize your work, to say that this is the kind of work that should live on and on the shelves and in the hands of kids. Wow, it's just overwhelming, and very little comes close to that.
Very belated, but a very big congratulations, a very hearty congratulations to you, and you definitely deserve it. Seriously, Rita, I think you are very courageous and very brave with all your writings and all your stories, and I admire you for that greatly. And what are some small, manageable steps that you would advise to writers to take every week that would get them closer to their goals of completing, let's say, their manuscript or their novel?
Have a schedule and stick to it. Have office hours that you stick to. Your writing is your business and it is your life. Even though we don't write 8 hours every day, the 1 hour, the 2 hours, the 4 hours that we put into it will mean so much more the next day, and the next. So it's the keeping those hours, the keeping faithful to the job and the profession and the craft of writing. Separate your generative self from your editing self. So calling on you to really acknowledge that there are different sides of your brain. Don't try to attack the writing with both. Stop editing as you write. Let the crappy, crappity, crap, crap flow. Okay. It's not going to be beautiful, but it will come out and you'll deal with it later. Usually it's the kernel that comes out of all of that crap that is going to set you free and set your story free in the future. And oftentimes it's that beautiful, illustrious, glorious writing that you have mothered and fostered and nurtured that is going to be sacrificed for the good of your writing. So respect both sides of your brain, but really let the generative side flow.
And to wrap it up, Rita, what are some recommended books or a favorite book of yours that you can recommend to our listeners to check out?
I'm very big into Annie Lamott, Bird by Bird. And then John Gardner's, I can't remember the title, but it's his book on writing fiction that I think is reexamined over and over and over again in everybody else's work. But I think also David House, and I think it's J-A-U-S-S, writes a really excellent book on writing fiction and really getting into narrative point of view.
Hey, storytellers, that wraps up our episode with Rita Williams Garcia. I love how warm and inviting she is throughout our entire chat. There were a lot of hilarious behind-the-scenes moments with Rita that had me laughing nonstop. A heartfelt thank you to Rita for being so generous with her time and all of her motivating and inspiring tips and advice for our listeners working on their own stories. To learn more about Rita, please visit www.ritawg.com. For a list of Rita's books and resources she mentions in her episode, head over to 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Rita Williams Garcia. And last but not least, a huge thank you to the Storyteller Tribe for joining me and listening in.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.